Today's speaker is Tom Needham. He needs no introduction. He is a longtime member of WOOF. For the past several years, he has been facilitator of the Humanist Discussion Group. Tom is retired, but he enjoys bicycle riding, tango dancing, and aspires to be a better amateur philosopher. His presentation today is "To Question Truly Is an Answer." Tom?
To question truly is an answer. Our theme for March is wisdom. So, what is wisdom? Well, for me, a practical definition of wisdom is information that will be helpful in deciding, helping me decide how to live a good life. How do you find wisdom? Ask good questions. And the problem is that we are overwhelmed with a tsunami of information. So here's part of the technique. As someone once said, wisdom is knowing what to ignore. I have a couple of criteria for what I'm looking for in wisdom. Is it useful? Not just interesting, but useful. Can it actually make a difference? And second, is it universal? I'm more interested in knowledge that applies to everyone. Doesn't matter who you are, young, old, men, women, black, white, straight, or gay. If you're human, I'm looking for wisdom that applies to you. I also want information that's lasting. I don't want something that 5 years from now is not going to be relevant. So here's a slight digression before we actually start. Why are you here? I mean, why are you in this place, in this time? I contend that the major reason that people come to churches is to find answers to these kinds of questions that I'm going to be offering. This is a place where you can grapple with the puzzles of existence. It's a place to search for truth and meaning. Unfortunately, many other religious institutions offer answers to questions, and they say, you can join us. All you have to do is just believe the same things we do. But Unitarians are different. Not only is it okay to ask difficult questions, we are challenged to ask the difficult questions. And then, even harder, we're expected to find our own answers. So, let's begin. I'll start today with the four best questions that I found in my life. The person that formulated these questions is Irvin Yalom. He's a former professor of psychiatry at Stanford Medical School, a psychiatrist in private practice, and novelist. After decades of clinical practice, Yalom concluded that what lay at the heart of his patients' most challenging inner conflicts were that his patients were human. And that as human, they and us, all of us, face the same four dilemmas that each of us needs to answer in our own way. Yalom calls these dilemmas existential because they are an inherent part of being human. They're an inherent part of the human existence. These are our ultimate concerns because we're alive. They are death, freedom, isolation, and meaning. So let's look at each of these briefly. Death. It's the big kahuna. We exist now, but one day we shall cease to be. Death will come, and there is no escape from it. Death haunts us as nothing else. We've been preoccupied with its dark presence, often just at the rim of consciousness since early childhood. In the arts, death has been a source of inspiration for thousands of years. There are several works, especially films, that have special resonance for me. I'm sure you have some that have special resonance for you in helping you understand death and your relationship to it. I'd be very interested in sharing these, mine and yours, when we have more time. Freedom. Ordinarily, we think of freedom as an unequivocally positive concept. Yet, in its existential sense, freedom refers to the absence of external structure. We are responsible for our own choices, actions, and ultimately, our life. Our choices can enhance our life, or it can compromise. Each of us must choose. Isolation. Now, this is not interpersonal isolation. That's loneliness. And this is not intrapersonal isolation in the psychological sense, where we're isolated from parts of ourselves. But this is a fundamental existential isolation from other creatures and from the world in general. No matter how close each of us becomes to one another, there remains a final, unbridgeable gap. Each of us enters existence alone, and each must depart from it alone. The conflict is the tension between our awareness of our absolute isolation and our wish for contact to be part of a larger whole. I have a personal example of isolation. My mother loved her only grandchild, Erica, more than anyone in the world, and the feeling was mutual. When my mother took her last breath, Erica was beside her, holding her hand. But even though Erica was with her, whatever journey my mother took at that moment, she took alone. Meaning, if we must die, if each of us is alone in an indifferent universe, then what meaning does life have? Why do we live? How shall we live? If there is no preordained destiny for us, then each of us must construct our own meaning in life. For me, death and meaning are connected. Our limited time alive forces us to make difficult choices that we might not otherwise make if we had unlimited time. And I continue to search for kind of the one ultimate question that kind of can surround all of these fundamental dilemmas. And so I can ask, what should we care about? What do we owe each other? And most importantly, how should we spend our time, since that's literally all we have here on Earth? That's the most important question that humans can ask. I found additional wisdom in a book called Spiritual Evolution by psychologist George Valent. Valent cites research which shows the brain in all human beings has evolved, hardwired in a sense, to feel certain kinds of emotions, both negative and positive. The negative emotions arose from our need for survival. Positive emotions arose from our need for unselfish parental love. Both are crucial for our survival, but they differ from each other in three critical ways. First, negative emotions focus only on the present moment. They help us survive in the present. In contrast, positive emotions help us survive in the future. Second, negative emotions narrow our attention, understandably, sometimes causing us to miss the forest for the trees. Positive emotions open us up, helping us to be more creative and flexible. And third, negative emotions focus our attention inward. Negative emotions focus our attentions inward on me. Positive emotions focus our attention outward on others. The most important of these emotions are the positive ones. Valent further contends that taken together, a specific group of these positive emotions can be considered to be kind of a pragmatic spirituality, totally independent of any kind of religious dogma. This set of positive emotions are a common denominator in all faiths and in all human beings all over the world. These eight emotions are compassion, forgiveness, love, hope, joy, faith, awe, and gratitude. Of these positive emotions, I'd like to focus on four this morning. Gratitude. Research has shown that gratitude is strongly correlated with happiness and satisfaction with life. That's certainly been true for me. A couple of years ago, I was diagnosed with a potentially fatal heart problem which required immediate major open heart surgery. As other people who have found with serious health problems, the experience wasn't fun, but it ended up being a positive, remarkable, almost life-changing. It was filled with connections with wonderful people, medical professional friends, my wonderful co-housing community. Afterwards, life experiences have become more intense and profound. My first night dancing tango afterwards seemed like a precious gift. Riding my bike through blossoming trees on a sunny spring day was never more intense. And I had epiphanies, too. Shortly after, I came out of anesthesia. One of the surgery assistants came into my hospital room and told me, "You have a beautiful heart." "I know. I've seen it." Awe. Awe is a belief in something greater than ourselves. A devout Tibetan Buddhist being studied while in deep meditation reported, "There's a sense of timelessness in infinity. It feels like I'm part of everyone and everything in existence." Intense Buddhist, Hindu, Native American, and Catholic devotional exercises can all lead to such feelings of connection. Indeed, this sense of loving mystical union was echoed even by a committed atheist, the astrophysicist and popular writer Carl Sagan. In the film version of his movie Contact, which I recommend highly, the central character says this: "I had an experience I can't prove. I was part of something wonderful, something that changed me forever, a vision of the universe that tells me how undeniably tiny and insignificant, and yet how rare and precious we all are. A vision that tells us we belong to something much greater than ourselves, and we are not, none of us, alone." Sometimes awe doesn't happen mysteriously, but is inspired by the unambiguously momentous. The 12 men who have walked on the moon were all engineers, all right stuff test pilots, but half of them when they returned from that experience, turned their backs on their NASA careers and devoted the remainder of their lives to concern with the Earth as a whole. I have felt great awe a number of times. I've experienced 3 total solar eclipses, an experience I recommend highly. But the greatest awe I have ever felt and still feel is something I started doing as a child. And I would look into a mirror, stare deeply for a long time into the eyes of the person that I saw there, and ask, who is asking this question? Now, doesn't everybody do that? I mean, it seems like part of being alive. Anyhow, okay, love. Oh my, love. People have spent lifetimes exploring love. For me, the metaphor with the greatest resonance about what love is the Velveteen Rabbit. It's a children's book about a toy stuffed rabbit that comes to life through a child's love. It recounts tenderly how love can make us real. It turns out that's more than just a metaphor. One researcher said we are not individuals who form relationships as much as we are individuals who are formed by relationships. There's a terrific book which I have returned to year after year. It's called The General Theory of Love. It's written by 3 physicians and brain researchers who look at brain science and find poetry. The essence of their profound message is this: who we love and who loves us create who we are. This is true not just in a metaphorical sense, but in a literal physiological sense. Our brains are wired by the relationships we have, especially early in life. When you look into the face of a baby, that baby is connecting several thousands of neurons while you watch. We learn to love from our genes, from our biochemistry, and most importantly, from the people who love us and those who let us love them. Compassion. Karen Armstrong, another source of wisdom for me, is a world-renowned religious historian and author of 20 books, including most recently 12 Steps to a Compassionate Life. She is also one of the creators of the Charter for Compassion through the United Nations. Here are her thoughts on questions. Religion is at its best when it asks questions and leaves you in a place of wonder. And at its worst, when it seeks to answer those questions in a definitive way. Here are her thoughts on compassion. In every subject I've turned my mind to, the history of God, of fundamentalism, everything kept drawing me back to compassion. I am now absolutely convinced that compassion is not just a nice idea, it's an urgent global imperative. It is essential to our survival. We live in a deeply interconnected world. What happens today in Afghanistan can have repercussions tomorrow in New York, in London. We are connected economically, financially, electronically, many ways. Yet we still think of ourselves as being in a special privileged position. And the golden rule has been developed in every single major world faith independently. It is the basis of true spirituality. It asks us to dethrone ourselves. Never treat others as you would not like to be treated yourself, Confucius said. Look into your own heart, discover what gives you pain, and then refuse under any circumstances whatsoever to inflict that pain onto anyone else. If we had implemented this globally, especially the colonial nations over the past three centuries, if we had treated other peoples as we would wish to be treated ourselves, we would not be having so many problems today. We can no longer pursue myopic, self-interested, nationalistic policies because we are now one people. The UN's Charter for Compassion is a call to action for all of us working together for a better world. We are all in this together. We must learn the art of reverence, of seeing something sacred and beautiful in one another. We must create the kind of global society that Confucius had in mind when he said, in which people not only live together with mutual respect, but in which every single member of that global society gives and receives a measure of absolute respect. This is the task of our time. I'm now going to turn to a shameless plug for the humanist group, of which I've been coordinating for a while. Let's start with, what is humanism? Well, the American Humanist Association's official statement, much abbreviated, goes as follows. Humanism is a rational philosophy. It affirms the integrity of each human being. It's free of theism and other supernatural beliefs, and asserts that humanity must take responsibility for its own destiny. The humanist group here at WOOF is engaged in a practical, pragmatic exploration. Emphasis on those two words, practical, pragmatic. Got to be useful. Practical, pragmatic exploration of the deep, rich history of human thought, the overlap between humanist thought and Unitarian thought, and the elements of a good life without the expectation of divine guidance or intervention. We look at issues relating to humans. There are a lot of those. We look at these issues through various lenses, philosophy, psychology, and biology. The big surprise for me in this journey is that when we've looked deeply into subjects that I thought were very easily understandable, such as ethics, forgiveness, and compassion, we've discovered that they're really difficult and tough and challenging. We don't talk much about whether God exists, atheists for believers. We assume that most people who join us don't expect any divine intervention and proceed accordingly. In three of our last four meetings, we've looked at compassion. And we looked at it from three different perspectives, psychology, evolution, and history. And it was hardly enough time. And on February 2nd, of course, we discussed Groundhog Day, one of the most profound and spiritual movies of recent years. Love, I'm not kidding. It's loved by Protestants, Catholics, Jews, Buddhists, psychiatrists, even humanists. It's my favorite movie. It should be yours, too. Let's talk about why. I've accumulated a list of all of our meetings going back to the start of 2018, and I'm going to add more to that list, and these will soon be accessible online, so you'll all be able to explore these areas that we've talked about. So what do I take away from all of this wisdom? I am profoundly grateful for being alive, for being alive here and now, for the gifts of health and consciousness, and most importantly, for all of the thoughtful, generous people who have been with me and helped me on this journey. As a result, I feel obligated to at least to spend some of my time and my gifts, what I've been so lucky to have, making the world better for me having been here. I'd like to close with a reading of the Peace Prayer of St. Francis, slightly modified. I'm sure you've heard it before, but I hope you'll hear it in a slightly different perspective now. Each line of the prayer is devoted to one of Valence's spiritual emotions. May I be an instrument of peace. Where there is hatred, let me sow love. Where there is injury, let me sow forgiveness. Where there is doubt, let me sow faith. Where there is despair, let me sow hope. Where there is sadness, let me give joy. And to all with whom I share this journey of life, may I give compassion. Thank you. Time for questions.
Will there be answers too?
Tom, thanks for your talk. Before you talked earlier today, you said that I would have already known everything you were saying, which is not a true statement. You are a humanist. I call myself a secular Buddhist. I think that we have very similar views on things, but somewhat different perspectives on them, and I would like to engage with you. I could talk a long time, but I'll only talk just a little bit more. Engage with you on some of these particular things. There are some specific things you said today that I would quibble with, the main one being that awe somehow entails belief in something or other.
I hope I didn't imply that. Well, I guess I do. It's a belief in something bigger than oneself, which doesn't necessarily mean supernatural, I suppose. But, I mean, my goodness, some years ago, I went to the Star Party in Central Oregon, and it's one of the darkest places that one can go. And I found myself learning about the stars and being able to really see the Milky Way for the first time and understand where the center of it was in the sky, that point in the sky, and the sense of being part of something huge filled me with awe. And I guess I had to believe in something that I couldn't sense with my individual senses. So I'm not sure that's perhaps a distinction without a difference.
Hi, Tom. I'm Mary Beth. I'm fascinated by the concept of isolation as it relates to awe, because there have been periods in my life where I felt very on my own, isolated, very singular. And yet at that moment when I'm out in the woods feeling that, I don't know if it's a sense of awe or what it is about being human, the feeling of connection to the natural world and even to the energy of people in a room. How can I feel so isolated and connected at the same time? And I think the little piece that triggered me was the idea of a gap. You mentioned something about a gap. And I know what little I know about Buddhism is they talk about there's this gap in which it's a gap and yet it feels connected. So I think for me, when I ask myself the question that I can't answer, it has something to do with that. Does that resonate at all?
These are dilemmas that you provide your own answers to. That's what's wonderful about being human, and what's one of the things that's wonderful about the fact that being a Unitarian is that process is encouraged. So, in some sense, I feel that as I described it, we are isolated, but in others, as our one of our principals says, we're part of the great web of all existence. I sometimes feel, as I said, it's grateful that I'm conscious enough to be aware of that I'm in the here and now, and I get to come up with my own answer. So I'll pass on that.
Something bigger than all of us, it just occurred to me, and it's nothing really profound, but I think the acknowledgement that there is a collective consciousness out there that we can be a part of if we choose so, it can bring comfort in our isolation. And if we just remember that, then we can expand our consciousness and be comforted in it.
There is there's a very interesting book by Michael Krasny. It's called Spiritual Envy. And it talks about, Krasny is a non-believer, but he's written a whole book about how he envies people who do believe. He said, my life could be so much more comfortable and easier if I were able to believe, but I can't. And he has some interesting, he said, I don't believe in God, but I miss him. And beliefs are, we need to find the beliefs that nurture us and that feel right for us. And that's what I was trying to emphasize, is that while I'm offering these questions, the answers are yours and only have to work for you, and they don't have to work for everyone else. And I know the concept of having a collective unconscious is the Jungians and the Buddhists and a whole bunch of different viewpoints find that persuasive, and that's great.
Thank you, Tom. I really appreciated hearing all of that. And I just want to say, in relation to words and semantics and what Mary Beth was asking, I wish the word, instead of isolation that he used, was solitude. I love the word solitude, and I think it has similar meaning, but just enough turn to make it a comfort. Even, you know, thinking of coming into the world alone and leaving the world alone, that is a solitude that is very beautiful to me. The other thing I wanted to say is that I'm reminded of the quote by Dr. Naomi Remen, who says that, and I'm paraphrasing because I don't have it quite down pat, but I think the phrase goes something like, the answers to the questions are not nearly so important as asking the questions in good company.
Thank you.
One of the reasons I was up there this morning with the choir is that I love music. And one of the things that your talk brought to mind is every once in a while, I also go to music camp where I'm in a bigger choir. Every once in a while, it didn't happen today. And when I'm singing with a group, I vanish. I become a conduit for music. I can't make it happen, and it doesn't happen often. But when it does, is it worth it or not?
Music is astonishing. Its effect on the human brain. When I'm dancing, sometimes I'll lose myself in the music. And I know that I've gone to music performances where I've lost the sense of time and present and who I was and where I was. Music, that would be a topic for another talk. But it's a wonderful... I'm tremendously grateful that the human brain is wired to have that find that effect in music.
Once I was by myself in an unbelievable, beautiful situation, and I was extremely sad because there wasn't anybody there else to share it with. And the first time I walked into a Unitarian church, which was probably 40 years ago, I was extremely happy to be able to talk to the people there. And it was a happiness I hadn't had before.
You found your place, as have I.
Thank you, Tom. That was very nice, very educational. I learned. I didn't know there were so many Buddhists in London. Now I understand why the signs say, "Mind the Gap."